Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. We spend a lot of time in this show talking about foreign affairs and Afghanistan. Most recently, we've talked about the number of troops who will be leaving the country, the state of security in the country, how the government is operating, the problems they may be having. Today, we have something different for the first hour of the program. Chip Duncan is joining us in our Milwaukee studios. Chip has been in Afghanistan twice. He was there on a tourism conference, the last go around in May. He visited Afghanistan for the second time. He'd been there the first time in 2005, and he's put together a beautiful book, Photographic Images, Enough to Go Around, Searching for Hope in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. Chip is a filmmaker, an author, a photographer, president of the Duncan Group, which is a documentary production company. He's worked on so many, many different issues and on presidencies. He's currently writing and directing a two-hour public television special called The Reagan Presidency, which will be broadcast in 2012. He's done all kinds of environmental documentaries. He's done other presidential documentaries on President Herbert Hoover, A History of Prayer in America, The Cost of Freedom, Civil Liberties, Security, and the USA Patriot Act. Done one on Henry Wallace. He's done lots of wildlife, rafting Alaska's wildest rivers, and I believe he's going back to Alaska soon to do more of that kind of documentary work. He's documented the work of Relief International teams following the earthquake in Pakistan. We talked to him after that, the genocide in Darfur, and the earthquake in Haiti. And we talked with him about all of those. Thank you very much, Chip, for being with us in our studio.
Always great to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Also joining us is Andrew Scanlon. And Andrew is joining us from Kabul in Afghanistan. He says he's in an armored building, so the reception may be good and bad. We hope that it's good at the moment. He is a protected areas expert and global environmental facility biodiversity program coordinator for the United Nations based in Afghanistan. Given that Afghanistan is one of the poorest and least developed countries in the world, this program prioritizes poverty reduction, livelihood generation, and protection of human health in the implementation of its activities. They are working to balance Afghanistan's ecological needs with human needs. And Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi. Thank you, Kathleen. Nice to be here.
You sound fine, and we should say that originally you're from Ireland. You're both really guys of the world, aren't you?
Still from Ireland.
Where from?
I said still from Ireland.
You're still from Ireland. I feel that way, too, and I've never really been. I've been there to visit, but that's where everybody came from in my family. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Let's start with you, Chip, and I know that you met Andrew. He helped guide you around Afghanistan. When you told me that you were at a tourism conference in Afghanistan, I thought to myself, a what in Afghanistan? A tourism conference in Afghanistan?
Yeah, it was the first ever tourism conference in Afghanistan since over the last 30 years or so anyway. And it was hosted by Governor Sarabi, Dr. Governor Sarabi, who's the only female governor in Afghanistan. She runs the Bamiyan province. Your listeners may remember Bamiyan as the place where 10 years ago, almost to the day, the Taliban blew up the Buddha sculptures that had been there since the 6th century. So she today, though, is the only female governor in Afghanistan. She hosted the conference. There was also a second conference in the Panjshir province, both really geared towards tourism. Mm-hmm. And development, of course. There's a lot of movement right now around development of agriculture, mining, oil and gas, that sort of thing. Google has an IT center now in Herat, and they're developing new technology there. Energy industry in Kabul is starting to pick up. And of course, tourism always drives the story if you can make it happen.
Mm-hmm. And they are rebuilding those Buddhas piece by piece.
Well, Andrew may be able to speak more to that than I am. The rebuilding's been a little controversial because it's costly, And also, from what I understand, there's some people who are suggesting it might be good to rebuild one and not the other, so that you'd have the legacy of the destruction by the Taliban in addition to the reconstruction. But when I was there, the scaffolding was in place on one of the two Buddhas, and there were archaeologists working there at the mm-hmm. time.
Andrew, how long have you been in Afghanistan? Hello, Andrew? I think the phone, well, we'll just keep trying. When we hear him,
That's the nature of the armored building, I guess.
I guess so. Do you know how long he's been there, the environmental program, the UN program?
I believe he's been there for a couple of years.
You're less clear than I am, Kathleen.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, okay.
Did you say how long?
How long have you been there, Andrew?
I've been in Afghanistan for 3 years, myself.
Mm-hmm.
Our program, the United Nations Environment Program, is in here since 2002.
And you,
we're working in. I've been here for 3 years myself.
And it's an interesting.
Our program since 2002, a couple of months after the modern Afghanistan started.
I would imagine in working on the many environmental issues in Afghanistan, you're also helping to. Forge relationships among groups that maybe didn't get along very well. You're building government in a way, aren't you? I'm not sure he's hearing me very well. But the interesting part of this program, he is.
And our legal right to be in Afghanistan is working with the government.
And tell me some of the projects that you're working on. There are many.
Well, yeah, I mean, our program, the environment program, since 2002, we have started working at the national level with planning and policy for water, for environment, the environment law, which was passed in 2007, and the forest law, which was passed 3 weeks ago after a long journey, and supporting the national government, especially the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Water and the Environment Protection Agency to get up and running and get their main work going, but not ignoring the fact that action on the ground is important too. So we support our provincial government offices of these ministries in the moment in 3 provinces and in an outreach program in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan. So the capacity building of the environment sector, not just the Environment Protection Agency, but all line ministries and even civil society working in an environment through a very broad swathe of projects, mainly working through government, but also with communities in terms of implementation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an ongoing process, which is being increasingly led by Afghans, young Afghans, and even older Afghans, who are taking responsibility for their own work and their own provinces and even their own national frame of development or national development strategy. So a very small UNEP, UN Environment Office, working with a large number of national government partners.
Chip, I think that the image that we have in this country is that Afghanistan is slowly unraveling, that the government is not working, that our time there has not been well spent, and it's been a long time that we've been there. You've been there twice now, and you were telling me that you noticed dramatic improvement in a 5-year period of time. How so?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind for people is security.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there are major security issues in the areas along the Pakistan border and Kandahar. Having said that, I think it may be a little hard for listeners to get their head around, but the majority of the country is really not fighting. The majority of the country is very peaceful. And so the north, the west, in particular, are fairly stable, and you're starting to see more and more development and development dollars coming in. And by that, I mean investment, not just government money. I thought the improvement between 2005 and 2011 was dramatic. And even in Kabul, I thoroughly enjoyed my time in Kabul. In Bamiyan, for tourists who may decide to go there over the next few years, probably largely adventure tourists, it's a community where you're safe to walk around. You don't need security. I walked hotel to hotel at night, went to the market on my own. Truly just a beautiful place surrounded by the Kohi Baba Mountains in the Hindu Kush Mountains. They have their first national park open there now. I think Andrew, you might want to ask him, but he, I think, told me earlier this week Sierra Club opened their first office in Afghanistan.
Really?
So it's a little counterintuitive based on the news that we tend to get. Certainly there are still, there's still fighting going on, but I think the people are very both tired of conflict and really ready to turn the page.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that assessment, Andrew?
Oh, totally, yeah. And like you said, you know, if you just take the suicide attacks, which are plentiful, and the security incidents, which are increasing, you're going to get a very negative picture of things. And if I talk to our security officers here in the UN, we would also get a very negative picture of things. And if you never left your concrete compound in Kabul, you probably would also have a very negative picture of things, and it's human nature to be afraid in such an environment. But if you actually get out into the provinces, as Chip said, the fighting, there's not a war going on. There's a lot of peace going on, and there's occasionally extremely dangerous incidents led by, I would say, my own personal opinion, misguided individuals and small groups who can do a lot of damage with a very one-off incident that takes 20 minutes or 30 minutes. I mean, in my own country, in the north of Ireland, we had this for 30 years, where a very, very small group of people was involved in upsetting a path towards development or a path towards a lasting foundation for a new country. And it's very easy to upset that. And that's the role of the anti-development, anti-government elements is not that difficult. It's very easy to disrupt things. And they, unfortunately, are the ones who attract all the attention. Despite that, there is an unbelievable amount of progress being made. There are an increasing number of excellent government employees, civil servants out there. And most important of all, there is the Afghan people who, in their local level, with their local stories, have been living on this land in a version of peace for hundreds, thousands of years. And right now, when you get out into the rural areas, places like Bamiyan, but not just Bamiyan, you've got a great deal of stability, a lot of poverty, and that's one issue, something that needs to be addressed, but certainly a relatively normal place, a lot more normal than Pakistan, by the way, where you have much more violence and brutality on a more regular basis. And another major, one of the things that we are looking at, of course, is the role of the potential for conflict in the future, and especially around issues like natural resources and the opportunity for environment and natural resources to create peace, sharing common issues such as water, rivers that flow from the central highlands through Helmand, Kandahar into Iran, and down into Pakistan, these kind of issues. Mm-hmm. So you really need to come here, Kathleen, and do your next show from Kabul and Bamiyan and maybe have some proper voice from the ground about the reality of life in Afghanistan for Afghan people, not just for us mollycoddled foreigners in our armored cars.
I'm game. I'll see if we can work something out. Yeah. We've had this wonderful gentleman from Nebraska who runs, who knows more about Afghanistan and the history than anybody I know, and we always contact him whenever there's a large event. He was one of the first Peace Corps volunteers in Afghanistan many years ago, and both of you can probably describe this as well. At the risk of making a terrible general statement about a whole country, there is something about, and you can see it in the faces in the book that you've done, which is gorgeous, Chip. There's something very welcoming about Afghan culture. There's something warm, and there's a cheerfulness on the faces of many of the people in this book, and it captivated him. He's been going there, you know, twice a year ever since.
Well, I've actually had the privilege of hearing your guest on the air a couple of times since I'm local and listen to your show. And he's a great guest, and he does say it well, I think. My experience, I'd share Andrew's observation about Pakistan versus Afghanistan. We tend to think of them collectively more and more, but I feel much more comfortable and vibrant in Afghanistan. And my experience with the people I've encountered there has been unbelievably positive. There's a sense of humor there that I don't find in other places, more of an upbeat and robust kind of character. The poverty is an enormous challenge, and women are still faced with huge challenges, women and children. But it's a much different place now than it was. Literacy has improved dramatically, and I think that's a good thing. There's more and more universities open. The Bamiyan University is now open. The First National Park is now open. So, you know, it's genuine progress, and I think in large part it's due to the fact that the people there are so welcoming and so warm.
You mentioned CHIP development money that's been going in. Let me ask you this, Andrew. There have been questions about that development money and whether or not it's getting into the wrong hands. Can you say, to the best of your knowledge, that this money is going to the right places? And if so, where is it going?
My official answer, no comment.
Yeah.
My personal answer would be that you have to look at different phases, 2002 to 2005. The latest government with Karzai after 2005, 2009, the current phase where most of the donors, and that's not just America, by the way, you know, there's with the Afghan Trust Fund, which is European and global economies investing into an Afghan government fund for on-budget support to the 32 ministries and departments and agencies, things like salaries. The police salaries being paid at the moment by the United Nations Development Program through donors. That kind of stuff is pretty transparent, and you can track it. Then you have the kind of military sector, the counterinsurgency funding, commanders funds, what they call the Commanders Emergency Response Program, which is a fairly large pot of money being spent with a little bit less discretion because it's supposed to be rapidly deployed. Again, you could query the value of spending money quickly versus having, say, an agricultural program that takes 7 years. You really need to look at specifically what you're talking about there. But and there has been mistakes made in the past in how funds have been spent, but I think there's a great awareness for that right now, and there's an understanding that with a $15 billion current spend per year in development in Afghanistan, but an incoming tax income of $1.5 billion, that something needs to change because the donors will not keep the funding up at that high level and the government's not making enough money. So we're looking at a kind of a phase going from 2014 to 2024 as donor funding is reduced and Afghanistan becomes more self-sufficient, where, to a certain extent, on budget, government, so donors would support the government based on their annual work plans, and then the various ministries would allocate to progress and tightly organized, and that's the way forward. And where are we in 2011? We're kind of halfway house. So There's still a great deal of military funding sloshing around, and being spent as best as can be, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But development needs to be done by development professionals, and that's where you have and government bodies with communities together, and that's where we're moving towards with organizations like the UN or USAID. And the 42 different aid organizations of other countries that are operating in Afghanistan at the moment.
Did you notice when you were in Bamiyan province, military presence, an American military presence, a development presence, Chip?
The security force in Bamiyan is largely from New Zealand. And of the various places I've been in Afghanistan, I would say they were the most casual and least armed and you know, pretty much welcomed by the community, and it's a really easygoing place. But the New Zealand forces have been there, I believe, since NATO first went in. Andrew may know that for sure, but the contingent was all from New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. And what about development projects? Did you see that at work in the province?
We saw it at work in several places. You know, certainly road building has been dramatic, and the difference in the quality of the infrastructure from 05 to 11 for me was quite stunning to see. When I was there in 05, I was largely in the Northwest and the North, and we were, you know, it was hard to even identify some of the roads as roads. So you're driving by compass sometimes. But now I would say that it's quite dramatic in terms of the difference. The road from Bamiyan to Lake Bandimere National Park is largely paved now. And those are the kinds of things that when you think of tourism, for example, whether international tourists show up or not, it makes it a lot easier for Afghans to enjoy their own country. And so you might have an Afghan community in Kabul that can make a 2-hour, 3-hour drive to Bamiyan and spend a weekend in the national park. And that's something that really wasn't even, you know, imaginable 10 years ago. But the road's paved. The national park is absolutely beautiful. It's the advisors for the park, I should say, are the Wildlife Conservation Society, working with the Kabul or with the Bamiyan government. And it's one of the more beautiful places I've ever seen, and at this point, really not developed. And so, unlike the lakes we might visit here in North America or over in Europe, it's just wild and beautiful. And when you get up into the Wakhan, I've not been in the Wakhan, but studying the Wakhan Valley, there's already a fairly significant tourist movement there. Richard Dunwoody, who was at the conference, he's an Irishman that leads tours. He's there right now with a group. And some really tremendous things are happening around wildlife and conservation in the Wakhan area, the Bamiyan area, the Panjshir area. Those are the places I've visited. And Andrew would know better than me where else that movement is taking hold.
We'll ask him that. We need to pause for just a moment. And once again, welcome phone calls. Different views on Afghanistan. We're looking at the possibility of tourism in the country and also talking about programs that will help balance Afghanistan's ecological needs with their many human needs. We have two guests with us this hour. Andrew Scanlon is joining us by phone from Kabul. He works for the United Nations. He's Protected Areas Expert and Global Environment Facility Biodiversity Program Coordinator. There's a title for the UN based in Afghanistan. He's originally from Northern Ireland. Chip Duncan, filmmaker, author, photographer, president of the Duncan Group, a documentary production company. He has done a book, a beautiful, well, he's done a lot of things. He did a lot of documentaries on all kinds of topics. His book is Enough to Go Around, Searching for Hope in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. He's been in Afghanistan twice, most recently in Bamiyan province, out of all things, a tourism conference. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Chrissy Pease is answering phone calls, and she'll get you on the air if you have questions for us. If not, we'll just carry on with our conversation. But we have done so many programs on unrest in Afghanistan, what U.S. policy should be in the country with the withdrawal of troops, that we haven't taken a look at what's going on the ground, in communities, how secure is the country, what progress has been made. So that's the focus of this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, we'll be speaking with Brian Fagan. Brian was with us before talking about his book on climate change. He's professor emeritus of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And I got to tell you, he has written one heck of a book on water. It must have taken so much effort to do this. It's a history, and I do mean a history, of ancient civilizations all over the world. And it's about water and humankind. You won't want to miss that conversation. It's such a thorough examination of the importance of water to our lives, but to our well-being and to our spiritual well-being as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we start our phone calls with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I wondered if the guests would like to comment to all of us American consumers out here about what kind of activity we might be able to engage in without actually traveling to Afghanistan. I've got a couple of old throw rugs that need to be replaced. They say made in Afghanistan on them. What is Afghanistan exporting these days that we here in the United States could benefit from, and also, would benefit Afghanistan?
Chip, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. There's a lot of things that are possible exports from Afghanistan. Certainly, carpets are one of them. I brought one home. I brought one home during both of my trips. They're beautiful, beautiful carpets. They have a wonderful industry for dried fruit, and there's a reason for that. To a certain extent, the reason that dried fruit industry sprung up was because it was hard to transport fresh fruit. So historically, the dried fruit industry is really strong. They have a lot of natural resources, obviously, natural gas, minerals, oil, you name it. But Andrew may actually have a better handle on some of that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the place to start would be with an organization that USAID helped set up, which was the Afghan Investment Support Agency, as a reflection of the fact that it's not just carpets and things and raisins in this country. It's far, far more more rich in that. This is just from the Himalaya down to the deserts. And I would encourage somebody who'd like to get an idea of the vast amount of things that this country does produce and would like to support, to have a look at this Afghan Investment Support Agency's website.
What is,
or to Google it.
What is the name of that again, Andrew?
Check it out.
What's the name again, please?
It's the Afghanistan Investment Support Agency.
Okay. Afghanistan Investment Support Agency.
The work that they've done is really great. And they were involved in bringing Chip from America over to Bamiyan and Panjshir. So check them out.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks very much, Bill, for the call.
One of America's greatest imports to Afghanistan.
What about the drug trade, trafficking, growing of poppies, et cetera, in Afghanistan? We also hear here that is a substantial part of the economy. Is that true? Andrew?
The Office for Drug Control in the UN has recently published a report on up-to-date figures in the last couple of weeks as the harvest is being, when it's actually growing in the fields, they can check it out and see how much, what's the increase or the decrease this year with good water and various factors in insurgency in agriculture, in prices, global prices, regional prices. Reduced prices for wheat, for example, has led to an increase in farmers growing poppy. It's definitely a problem. It's a substantial part of the economy. I don't know the exact figures this year, but it's around, 30-40%.
Is it? Were you aware of that part of the economy when you were in Bamiyan Province, Chip, or not? Is it something that's...
There's almost no poppy in Bamiyan. For agricultural reasons as well as for economic and cultural reasons and a very stable, secure, reasonably strong rule of law, mm-hmm. the police, and of course their support from the international community and the New Zealand security force. But places like Badakhshan, up towards the Wakhan corridor, bordering on Tajikistan, which wouldn't have had poppy, I've seen poppy this year. So I wouldn't like to comment any more than just my general knowledge on that. But it's a problem, and it's not... I wouldn't be an expert in that area, but it seems to be related to many factors where, and food security being one of them, where as food security increases, the chances of farmers growing poppies increases as well, because they're in an insecure situation. They're going to make sure they grow wheat because not starving would be the first priority. And even if you grow a poppy, you may not get the payback till later in the year. And there's a lot of uncertainty there. And, of course, it's illegal. But, you know, situation of increased security and better development stats, there seems to be an increase in poppy growing. And I wouldn't say that's the rule, but that's certainly something that I've observed.
Buck is next in Madison. Hi, Buck.
Hello. I was in Afghanistan when they still had a king riding a horse through Pagman to the west down the Hari Rud. And I thought, man, what a wonderful country this is. I had come from India and Nepal where there were all these restrictions on people, and they made their own firearms. And the bank tellers said, you can get a better rate at the money bazaar if you want to change, right? And there were almost no restrictions on people. It was the freest country I'd been in for 2 years, you know? And nobody should ever invade Afghanistan, right? Like Nepal and Vietnam and Somalia, they get really upset. But if you're meeting them and traveling among them, they are so nice and hospitable, and they have wonderful fruit.
When were you there, Buck?
Oh, it was years ago. It was 72, you know, or 71, when they still had a king before the Marxist whippersnappers did all this damage to the country, and we're suffering from it even now. And I'm glad to hear that things have calmed down somewhat and tourism is a possibility and we can go and buff with Afghanis.
Thank you, Buck, very much for the call. Chip.
I think Buck is one of many who visited Afghanistan in the 60s and 70s. It was a major tourist area at the time for people traveling overland, especially from Europe to India. But it has a long history of having travelers come through. The Bamiyan province is certainly marketing the Silk Road right now. They're part of the Silk Road, and they have a Silk Road Festival later this month. So it's always been a great place for travelers. It's a landlocked country, so in many cases people have to go through it to get to wherever they're headed. But the tourist movement, I think if they could recapture some of the spirit of that, especially for adventure travelers that existed in the 60s and 70s, that would certainly be a wonderful thing. I wanted to, you know, give you a little bit of a picture of what tourism looks like in Bamiyan right now,
sure,
versus where they're headed. Some of the fun facts that came out of the lecture and the conference that I was at, there are now 470 registered travel agencies in Afghanistan. Having said that, in the Bamiyan area last year, the gentleman who was doing most of the tourist activities in the winter there said he had 41 international skiers. 41, and they were mostly expats, internationals living in Kabul. And in terms of equipment, he said he had 35 pairs of ski boots and poles, mostly cross-country skis, and they lost 50 potential customers last year due to the fact that there were no flights. So the airport is still a big part of the issue, their development of the infrastructure for the airlines in and out, which is the most secure way for internationals to get in and out. But as he was doing his lecture, one of the funnier things was he said he had a couple of travelers come up, and he had skis and he had boots. It's just that the boots didn't necessarily match. So, I mean, that's how basic it is. Mm-hmm. At the same time, their long-term goals, their vision for 2015, as they call it, is that they are hoping to have as many as 10,000 international travelers by 2015 and as many as 100,000 Afghan travelers by 2015. And personally, having seen it and been there, I think it's very doable. There are some, by Western standards, modest but very comfortable hotels, a couple that are already there and several more that are being built. And a major commitment from the international community to do the infrastructure and training that would be required to bring people in so that you have English-speaking translators and guides and that sort of thing. So it is a very positive future, I think.
They have a long way to go, it sounds like, Chip. A long way to go.
They do have a long way to go, but, you know, I happen to, for fun, I guide in Peru once a year in November. And when I first went to Peru, the Shining Path was in power. The terrorism was the issue, and they were getting 100 visitors a day at Machu Picchu. And today they're getting 2,500. So, you know, that's hope.
Yeah, there is hope. What about all of this? Let's just spend a few minutes, Andrew, on the history of Afghanistan that has been such a hard place to live for such a long period of time, war after war after war. What gives you hope in your work there that perhaps things may be able to change? Is it a spirit among the Afghan people? Is it enough development that they can turn a corner? Surely war has to have beaten a lot of people down.
Sorry, you broke up there, Kathleen. Is that for me?
Yes. If you heard me.
one thing I would say is that Afghanistan, I mean, just let's look at the landscape. It's naturally arid. It's dominated by desert or semi-desert, and virtually the entire supply of water, irrigation, drinking, maintenance of wetland ecosystems is surface river flow coming from the water towers, the ice fields in the Hindu Kush. It's not an easy landscape. So a lot of what people mistake for total destruction caused by war and fighting, and people love to talk about the war here, even the Afghans do, it's just a very difficult landscape anyway. So, you know, you're not going to have like the forests of Switzerland or the green fields of Ireland in Afghanistan. It's never been like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what's mistaken for degradation is just a naturally arid, desert-dominated, semi-desert-dominated landscape. So, I mean, that's part of what we look to, is to say we need to understand where we came from, what this place and what the natural systems looked like and what the cultural systems looked like before as well. And then moving forward, yes, absolutely, the people who have been hardened and toughened, and they must be the toughest people on the planet, by this landscape, not by the war, but just by being from the steppe and being from the desert and being from the Hindu Kush. They're tough people, and they've got some real champions. They've got some real talent. They've got some great young people. I mean, there's the amount of the population of under 25 is over 50%, so you're really going to have a new generation coming. And as we see in the Arab Spring, it's the youth that can change things. So sometimes the older generation forgets that, and lo and behold, there's a major shift. Another thing, just on the king, well, his grandson, Mustafa Zahir, Zahir Shah was the king. Mustafa Zahir is now he is the prince, but there is no royal family anymore. But he's the head of the Environment Protection Agency.
No.
He came back.
Oh, my.
To lead this organization. And he runs this thing. He recently received the Hero of the Planet Award, which is a major global environmental award for his work on the environment. And in terms of conservation and tourism, where that meets, in my view, would be with the national parks, protected areas, wetlands, and nature reserves system that he's working on with our help, with Wildlife Conservation Society support, USAID support, a series of 30 national parks and conservation areas around the country, which used to belong to his grandfather in the old system, because they were royal hunting reserves, places like Adyar Valley and the Wakhan Corridor. And a lot of what we now have is kind of community centers, visitor centers, used to be royal hunting lodges back in the 60s. He's a true champion, and people like him are around, and that's where the future lies, absolutely.
I was interested in, you do so many different programs, the development of a program, I don't know if this is up and running or not, that deals with the complementary aspects of Islam and the environment, which your material says has been very well received by Afghan institutions and people. Can you talk more about that, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be UN material. This is material we work on with Afghan Islamic scholars who understand the phrases, the lines from the Quran, where the environment is described, is mentioned, is embraced, encouraged, and believe me, there's a lot of areas of true appreciation for nature and environment in the Quran and anything Islam. Mm-hmm. And we worked with a document which IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, had been working on to have an Afghan approach to that. It's something that that particular document, yes, absolutely well received by ulamas, by mullahs, and by university students, professionals. But it's also an approach to sharing information on the environment and on nature that we're looking to work with more on. Not that UNEP is working on, but that the our partners in government, our colleagues in the university, and government partners in the Ministry of Hajj, the Holy Ministry, they really understood the importance of finding Afghan context environmental messages, and not just something like our westernized notion of wilderness and wild nature and just being out on the mountain. But by tourism, okay, foreigners, they want to come and go with Richard on the horseback riding up in the Lakhan, but Afghans want to travel with these on Friday, on the holy day, and then you want to go and have a picnic, beautiful down the whole family, and you're talking about coming out for a picnic, and therefore the nature approach needs to be touched. Experience when I was working in Yosemite National Park a couple of years back, Austin, who was superintendent there, and he was trying to get more non-Anglo-Saxon Americans to come to Yosemite because it was totally skewed. Even though the population of California was far more demographically spread, with 90% Anglo-Saxon and 95% international, and 5% the rest. And they had a massive effort to try and increase participation in visitation to the National Parks of America. And one of the main, most successful efforts was putting in large picnic tables around Yosemite Falls and in popular areas, and quadrupled the visitation by a non-traditional kind of...
Isn't that fascinating?
...bearded Sierra Club types in the space of 2 years. And this is really, by the way, that's totally increased and is on the increase since then. But in Afghanistan, something very similar. We have to look at how Afghans want to appreciate nature and enjoy nature. Looking at Islam and the environment is one way to do that. Mm-hmm. And with the national parks and nature reserves and nature areas, looking at family visitation rather than kind of mountain climbing and rock climbing, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Understanding cultures. We're talking about Afghanistan this hour of the program. Andrew Scanlon is joining us by phone, which is why the connection is kind of in and out. He's in an armored building in Kabul, so the reception, but we can hear most of what he's saying. He's protected areas expert in global environment by facility biodiversity program coordinator for the United Nations, based in Afghanistan. Chip Duncan is joining us in our downtown Milwaukee studios. He is based in Milwaukee. He's an author, photographer, president of the Duncan Group, a documentary production company, and he's done marvelous work all over the world, including in Afghanistan. And he does presidential documentaries, a lot of wilderness documentaries. He is joining us. He has just returned from Bamyan province, where they had a conference on possibility of big tourism in that province in Afghanistan. We welcome phone calls. We have time for a couple more if you would like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And we do have on our Facebook page, if you go to the Kathleen Dunn Show, Chip has some of his extraordinary pictures from Afghanistan on that site, so you can look at what we're talking about, which is a good thing to broaden your experience. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Thursday, the author of Elixir, A History of Water and Humankind, Brian Fagan, who's also author of the bestseller The Great Warming. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I also want to ask about your book, Chip, which is just gorgeous enough to go around. Was this from 2005, your journey in 2005?
Yes, the images in the book, the book was published in 2009, and the images in the book are from the 2005 trip.
Yeah.
Which I did that trip with Save the Children. And then the Pakistan and Sudan parts of the book I did with Relief International.
And tell the audience where you're such a guy of the world. Where are you going next? The Reagan documentaries, you're still working on that. You're going to Alaska. You're going to Washington. Where are you going?
Thanks to the incredible staff that my colleagues that I get to work with, Bob Huck, Pat Ostermich, and Theron Pfeiffer, that allows me to do a lot of the traveling that I do. So we're in production on the film on the Reagan presidency and also a film on climate change that looks at glaciers. And so for the fifth summer in a row, I'll be up filming glaciers the first couple weeks of August in the St. Elias Range in Alaska and Western Canada.
Hmm. We go to Bill from Elroy. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, I was just listening to this fellow telling this rosy picture about the Afghanistan and the road building and national parks and how wonderful the people are, which I'm sure they are. But it's just an incredible contrast when you said, "Oh, this fellow that's on the phone that comes in and out, he's in an armored building in Kabul." So I just cracked up. I said, okay, there's a healthy shot of reality right there.
Bill, thanks for the call. What kind of building are you in, Andrew?
Actually, I've just stepped outside into the garden.
All right, he's in a garden now.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
For security reasons, there's what we call operating security standards. I work for an organization, the United Nations, that has rules, and I totally agree. It's not paradise here, but we work in this environment, and of course, Kabul has a higher security status than places like Bamiyan, the Central Highlands, which are. Haven't seen a major security incident in 8 years. So I totally agree with the caller. Yes, there's dangerous places. There are people in this country who would rather see the place collapsing and that we would live in insecure environments forever. I'm certainly not one of those people, and we work towards a better tomorrow, but certainly we have to be realistic about the threat levels on a specific location-based daily.
How bad, Andrew, was the incident at the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul? And how shaken up were people like you by that?
Sorry, Kathleen, can you say it again, please?
The incident where people died at the hotel where a lot of foreign journalists stay in Kabul, was it 2 weeks ago? Did that shake you?
We were aware that was going on, and those incidents happen on a quite regular basis with groups of anti-government or insurgents, as they call them, and it's an issue. But they are not, I would not say they are, in many cases they're not even Afghans, they come up from Pakistan.
Uh-huh. All right, let's go to another phone call. Thanks, Bill, for the call. Pat in St. Cloud. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm calling because I have an article from the Sierra Club magazine in my hands, and it's called Wilderness Diplomacy. And it the Afghans evidently did not know, because all we have are movies and things that they may have seen concerning what the American people and the American countryside looks like. And this is a book on the national parks being shared with Afghans, and incredible pictures of people looking at them at the book and understanding that we are not what we present as far as war and images that they may know about, see about us. And so I thought it was tied in with your guest today, and it is an absolutely remarkable article.
Thank you very much for the call. How do you balance, Chip, what you see in terms of news coverage in the United States and political discourse over Afghanistan, how many troops, what are we doing there, et cetera, with what you see when you're there? Is it jarring to you? Is there something that we need to know that we're not seeing?
In terms of crisis zones and conflict zones that I visited, I think it's... it's a little hard for anyone to get their head around how there can be a place like Bamiyan that's in, or Wakhan, that are these beautiful, secure parts of a country where most of the news that we hear is negative and about destruction and war and terrorism. But the nature of commercial media right now is a whole other topic for a whole other show. And for the most part, whether it's cable television or network television, they tend to thrive only on the dramatic and, and negative stories. So thanks to, you know, organizations like the BBC and public television and National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio in particular, you know, there are other sides to every story. And you guys provide the depth that other people don't. So I found most of the time it's all about the people wherever you go. And most people, in my experience, are good.
Hey, that's a good way to end. Thanks, Chip. Chip Duncan, president of the Duncan Group, a documentary production company. Some of his photos on our website, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we thank Andrew Scanlon, who is working with the United Nations, protected areas expert and global environment facility biodiversity program coordinator. There's a title for you for the United Nations based in Afghanistan. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show. Thanks to Crispy Peace for on-air production.